it's really a great pleasure to be here. So my main goal for this talk is going to be to tell you about some of the ways that Scrum Dynamics, and in particular approximately scale invariant or conformal dynamics, might potentially play an extremely important role in beyond the standard model physics. In order to motivate why you might want to think about new strongly coupled, approximately scaling invariant dynamics, I want to start with a brief review of our current picture of particle physics and how it breaks down. Certainly our picture of the universe has changed rather dramatically over the last, say, century or so. Perhaps one of the most important developments in our understanding has been learning that our universe is very well described by local Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. Okay, so this is the framework that consistently combines quantum mechanics and special relativity. Particles are associated with excitations with quantum fields, and the interactions between quantum fields are local in space-time. Now, within this framework, we've learned that there are three generations of matter fields, each generation consisting of quarks and leptons. These are spin 1/2 particles obeying Fermi statistics. We've also learned that there are three non-gravitational forces mediated by spin 1 particles, electromagnetic strong and weak forces. And then there's gravity, which is mediated by a spin 2 particle, the gravity. The electromagnetic and strong forces are in fact mediated by massless spin 1 particles, the photon and the gluon, respectively. And massless spin 1 particles contain two physical degrees of freedom. And intuitive way to see this is to imagine, say, a photon zooming along at the speed of light, say, along the z-axis. And it's a spin 1 particle, so it's a vector particle, it has an arrow. And then there are two orthogonal directions that the arrow can point, in the x and y directions, that rotate into each other under transformations that leave the four momentum of the particle invariant. Okay, namely transformations that leave the particle still moving at the speed of light in the z direction. Okay, so there are two degrees of freedom, two physical polarization states. On the other hand, if we want to describe massless spin 1 particles in a Lorentz invariant way, we need to do so using Lorentz vectors, a mu, and then the problem is that Lorentz vectors contain too many indices to describe particles with only two degrees of freedom. One way to get around this is to introduce redundancies into our description of the physics. So for example, we can identify a mu with a mu plus tau mu alpha, alpha. And this redundancy, often called the gauge redundancy, is introduced for the purpose of maintaining a manifestly Lorentz invariant and local description of the physics. Or generally, gauge transformations like this are associated with the group structure, and electromagnetism corresponds to a U1 gauge group, and the strong force corresponds to an SU3 gauge group. Now the weak force is a little bit more confusing, because the weak force is mediated by massive spin 1 particles, the W plus minus and Z gauge photons. And massive spin 1 particles contain three physical degrees of freedom. The way to see this is to note that because they're massive, you can go into their rest frame, and then there are three orthogonal directions that an arrow can point that rotate into each other under transformations that leave the particle at rest, leave the four momentum invariant. And we've, of course, learned that the W and Z gauge bosons are massive over and over again in collider experiments. On the other hand, the interactions of the W and Z gauge bosons can nicely fit the pattern of an SU2 cross U1 gauge theory, which is then broken down to the U1 corresponding to electromagnetism. So then the big question is, well, how does this breaking happen? And where do these three extra degrees of freedom come from, corresponding to longitudinal polarizations of the W and Z? If you are a minimalist, you say, okay, we can start with an SU2 cross U1 gauge theory because you know the interactions with that structure. Then we can introduce three new degrees of freedom into our theory. Let's call them pi a. We can group these new degrees of freedom together into an object sigma, which transforms in a simple way under SU2 plus U1 transformations. And then it's easy to write down the most general interactions, coupling sigma to itself, to the other gauge forces, and to the other matter fields. And you end up with an effective field theory that is remarkably successful at describing physics at low energies that we observe. In particular, because we've introduced these new degrees of freedom, the W and Z can have masses, and that's no problem. The main problem with this framework is that if you think about scattering processes involving a longitudinally polarized W and Z gauge bosons, then scattering amplitudes start to grow as a function of the center of mass energy. They go like center mass energy squared divided by the W mass squared. And eventually, at high energies around 1 TeV, this becomes a large number. This description of the theory becomes strongly coupled. An infinite number of higher dimensional operators start getting equal contributions to the scattering amplitudes. And you completely lose the ability to make predictions. Okay, so that's the problem. You stop being able to make predictions in this framework around 1 TeV. So then the big question is, well, is there some better description of TeV scale physics that we should be using? Okay, and of course there have been many, many proposals for what this might look like. One of the most common ones introduces a new particle, the Higgs boson, but you can also have more extended Higgs sectors if you want. Another idea is that there's some sort of strong dynamics responsible for electroweak symmetry breaking, something goes under the name of technicolor. Another fascinating idea is that there are new dimensions of space that open up at the TeV scale. Another beautiful idea is that there's a new symmetry of nature relating fermions to bosons, supersymmetry, which enters at the scale. And basically, any combination of these ideas that you might care to put together has probably been proposed at some point or another in the literature. So we have no idea which idea or combinations of these ideas is right. So one of the simplest ones, and that a lot of people believe, is that there's a new particle which enters up the TeV scale, or maybe a few hundred GeV, called the Higgs boson. This introduces one new scalar degree of freedom as compared to what we've already observed in nature. We can group this new scalar degree of freedom together with the three that we contained in our sigma object in order to form a complex doublet under SU2. Okay, so a complex doublet has four components. So let's call this complex doublet capital H. And then we can write down potential for capital H involving the mass term H dagger H, coordinate coupling H dagger H squared. And if the coefficient of the mass term happens to be negative and of order a few hundred GeV squared, when this potential gets minimized, electroweak symmetry will break, the W and Z will get their masses, and everybody's happy. So what is the good thing about introducing one new degree of freedom? Well, it allows you to have a perturbative, predictive description of TeV scale physics. Okay. In particular, if you think about WW scattering, then Higgs boson comes in to save the day. Scattering amplitudes cease to grow, like the center mass energy squared, and you can make predictions up to very high energy scales, and potentially bring the cutoff scale of your theory up to the Planck scale or the scale of gravity. Okay, so that's the good. The thing that might make you somewhat uncomfortable about this is that we've introduced a new dimension 2 operator into our description of nature, this H dagger H operator. And this is the source of what is often called the hierarchy problem. And at its core, the problem is that it's very confusing as to why the coefficient of this operator should be something small, like the TeV scale, rather than something big, like the Planck scale. And this is especially confusing when you think about the quantum corrections to the coefficient of this operator, which are very, very sensitive to cutoff scale physics. And it's just very hard to see what sort of UV completion to this picture would allow this parameter to be naturally small. Okay, so there's no inconsistency, but it's just very, very confusing. Another thing that might make you worry about whether or not this is the right story is that this is introducing a new fundamental scalar particle into our description of nature. And all scalar particles that we've seen in nature so far have ended up being composites of some sort or another. And this at least might give you pause that introducing a Higgs boson at least at the fundamental scalar level might be a little bit too quick. Well, and if you don't like that, an alternative is to imagine that some sort of strong dynamics. Yeah?
It has to be fundamental. And suppose it was
fundamental. It doesn't have to be fundamental. So yeah, good. There are lots of theories where you have what looks like a scalar degree of freedom, the UV scale, but it's ultimately composite built on the formulas. And that's another option that you can think about. Absolutely. An alternative to a Higgs boson as a nice, well-defined particle that enters a PEV scale is that there's strong dynamics, which is responsible for electroweak symmetry breaking. The idea is pretty straightforward. You have some new gauge group. Let's call it a technicolor gauge group. It has some coupling, which is small at high energies. As you go to lower energies, quantum corrections cause the effective strength of the coupling to grow. And then eventually at a scale which is exponentially suppressed relative to the scale that you started at, the coupling blows up, the theory confines, and the electroweak symmetry is broken. So this potentially gives a nice resolution to the hierarchy problem in that it explains why you have a very small scale relative to the scale of gravity in your theory. And then a simple picture in this story is that your theory contains some operator which has the same quantum numbers as our Higgs capital H field. Maybe it's built out of fermions, psi bar psi. And when the theory confines, psi bar psi picks up an expectation value which breaks electroweak symmetry and gives the W and Z their masses. Now, one reason why this idea maybe isn't so crazy is that it basically already happens in nature. Okay, so if you think about QCD, the QCD coupling is small at high energies. As you go to lower energies, the effective strength of the coupling increases. We've measured this in several different ways. And then eventually at a scale, say around 200 MeV, the theory confines. And in fact, there's a fermion bilinear built out of quarks, Q bar Q, which picks up an expectation value that would, in fact, break electroweak symmetry if it weren't already broken. Okay, so QCD basically does everything that you would want in a theory of electroweak symmetry breaking. It just does it at the wrong scale. So then you can ask, well, why can't this story just repeat itself at higher energies? Well, there are some challenges to getting this idea to work. One of the biggest challenges is getting a successful theory of flavor. And the reason is really the top quark. So in theories where the Higgs operator is really a fermion bilinear, psi bar psi, then if I want to write down a mass for the top quark, I need to write down an operator like psi bar psi, top left, top right. This is a 4 fermion operator, so it's a dimension 6 operator. Thus it's suppressed by some scale squared. Let's call it lambda some flavor. And if you have some physics at the scale lambda flavor that you integrate out to generate this coupling, very generically, it will also generate other 4 fermion couplings. And in particular, it will generate 4 fermion couplings that might have some random flavor structure. So then the problem is that in order to suppress contributions to flavor-changing neutral current processes coming from these operators, this scale has to be larger than about 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 TeV. Okay, and some of the strongest constraints come from KK bar mixing. On the other hand, if you want to give the top quark a large mass, around 174 GeV, then you want this scale to be not much bigger than 1 or 2 TeV. Okay, so there's a clear tension if whatever physics generates the top mass operator also generates random 4 fermion operators that violate flavor. And I should say this tension is kind of realized in lots of explicit models that people are trying to construct. Another potential source of tension comes from precision measurements of the electroweak sector. In particular, the strongest constraints often come from what are called the S and T parameters. The S parameter measures kinetic mixing between SU2 and U1, which is induced by electroweak symmetry breaking. The T parameter measures the relationship between the W and Z masses. And at least in kind of naive, scaled-up QCD versions of Technicolor, the S and T parameters, or at least the S parameter, seems like it often comes out too big to nicely fit with measurements performed at LEP and the Tempotron. I should say this is particularly a challenge for large N theories, where the S parameter often scales like N. And you can easily get way out here and very much outside this oval. Of course, I should say that in many, many theories of Technicolor, the theory is just strongly coupled. It's very hard to calculate anything. And you might still hope that S and T come out right. So if you take that attitude, maybe this isn't a serious problem, then the real thing to worry about is the flavor sector.
NDA, how does
meeting come? So this NDA is naive dimensional analysis. This is a method for kind of estimating contributions of strong physics to various processes, and it's basically a way of counting factors of 4 pi. It's kind of a naive estimate of what value of the coupling would cause the coupling to be strongly coupled at the scale of strong dynamics. But this box isn't something that you should take very, very seriously.
We get it. Write down something that are entering, showing that it's close or minus magnitude about 0.2 to 0.6. What coupling are we talking about?
Let's see. Where is that? I need to think about exactly where 0.6 comes from, but this is a naive estimate of factors of 4 pi. Okay, I stole this plot from Marcus Luddy, so I need to look up exactly where his factors of 2 come from. The main bad thing about Technicolor models is that you generically run into big flavor problems. The source of this problem is a Higgs operator, is a dimension 3 operator, causing the top quark to get its mass from the dimension 6 operator. On the other hand, the good thing about Technicolor models is they nicely solve the hierarchy problem. One way to state that they do this is that it doesn't contain any low dimension relevant operators that are Gaussian invariant that you can add to the Lagrangian. So in particular, the H dagger H operator that we were worried about in the case of a Higgs boson is a dimension 6 operator, which is irrelevant. Okay. Now you might say, wait a second, right now we're kind of doing naive countings of classical dimensions of operators, and quantum effects can give operators anomalous dimensions. And you might say, well, maybe large anomalous dimensions can change some of this, these problems, which are stemming from kind of classical dimensional analysis. Well, if you want these effects of anomalous dimensions to try to fix up these tensions with flavor, you really want large anomalous dimensions, and you really want large anomalous dimensions to exist over a wide range of energy scales so that the effects can really start to pile up. Now, in order to get large anomalous dimensions, you need strong dynamics. So what you really want is strong dynamics over a wide range of energy scales. Now, probably the only way we know how to have strong dynamics over a wide range of energy scales is to have some sort of scale invariant or conformal dynamics.
Yeah, but each, just putting it as a type of sign, it seems too naive to me. Unless you tell me what the kinetic term bar back bar is. If it's a standard kinetic term, then I should rescale H to bring it down to a dimension one field.
Yeah, that's right. So this counting occurs in the picture that I explained earlier, where you have some new asymptotically free gauge group, where you have fermions that are merged into that gauge group.
It won't be consistent if I tried to do that in condensed matter, I would get the same counting, but that's not what happens. I get dimension one fields.
That's right. So this counting is very naive. I mean, here we're kind of identifying what operator H came from in the UV description of our theory, but that may be very different from what the operator looks like in the
I guess it's meaningless unless you tell me what the kinetic term for that is.
No, I agree. So,
is your Higgs fundamental?
Sorry?
Is your Higgs fundamental?
In this case, no. So at high energies, the description is that you only have these fermions psi that are charged under your Higgs group, and that's right. And then the Higgs operator is a condensate.
What about renormalizability?
I'm sorry?
What about renormalizability? Is the theory normalizable?
Sure, you can imagine that the high energy theories are renormalizable.
Imagine.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I haven't given you written down a concrete model here. I've just explained one picture of the physics, and the hope would be that you have a renormalizable theory in the UV, potentially. Another thing to worry about is here. In order to give the top quark a mass, I had to write down non-renormalizable operators. And so in order to have a renormalizable description of high energies, I need to explain where these operators come from. So what I want to tell you is that scale invariant or conformal dynamics can help fix some of these tensions. And this is a very old idea called walking technicolor. And the idea is that your theory has a gauge coupling, which becomes strongly coupled at some scale lambda star. It enters a regime of approximately conformal invariance or scale invariance. So the coupling stays fixed as you change energy scales. And then eventually something kicks it out of this conformal regime and causes, and the theory confines and breaks electroweak symmetry. So, how does this help? if in this conformal regime, the H operator, that is the thing that condenses, has a dimension which is very different from 3, this interaction, which gave you the top quark mass, gets enhanced by a factor of lambda star over lambda IR to the power of 3 minus the dimension. Okay, so an anomalous dimension for this H operator leads to an enhancement in the coefficient of the operator, which gives the top quark its mass. Okay, and in particular, if the dimension of H is very, very far from 3, maybe in many models, people imagine it's close to 2. You could also imagine that it's close to 1. And if this is a few orders of magnitude between lambda star and lambda IR, then this enhancement can be very, very big, allowing you to bring this lambda flavor scale up to high energies and avoid constraints from flavor changing neutral current processes. Okay. And sort of an ideal kind of scenario would be having the dimension of this H operator be fairly close to 1, maybe 1.2 to 1.5 would be sufficient. And this could allow you to bring the flavor scale up to 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 TeV. And then generic flavor violating 4 quark operators that are generated by this physics at this scale will not be problematic. On the other hand, we'd like to still maintain the fact that we have a solution to the hierarchy problem. And so we don't want any relevant operators in our theory, like H dagger H. And in particular, we'd like the dimension of the H dagger H operator to be greater than 4. Okay? having a conformal field theory with the dimension of H very close to 1 and the dimension of H dagger H greater than 4 is something that we would like to have in this scenario, and we don't actually know if there exists a conformal field theory having these properties. Okay, so a little bit later, I'll tell you about some recent work that has been done in order to place bounds on scenarios like these. Where you have some operators which sort of look like they're close to being free fields, other operators built out of them have very, very large dimensions which are far from what you would expect in a free field limit. So I'll come back to that bit a little bit later. Now I want to take a step back a little bit and mention that this framework of having a window of energies where you have approximately conformal dynamics and operators pick up anomalous dimensions is a much more general one and could potentially solve a lot of other puzzles in beyond the standard model physics scenarios. The basic thing which is universal in all of these scenarios is that you have a regime of approximate conformal invariance, operators have anomalous dimensions, if I add an operator to my approximately conformally invariant Lagrangian, then the coefficient of that operator will undergo power law or normalization group running at a rate controlled by the anomalous dimension. And in particular, the coefficient will get suppressed or enhanced by a factor of the renormalization scale over the scale at which you entered the conformal regime raised to the power of the anomalous dimension. The basic point is that this suppression or enhancement, depending on the sign of the anomalous dimension, has the power to create hierarchies. Okay? This can be, you know, a very, very tiny number. So really anywhere in nature that you see a hierarchy, you should stop and think, well, maybe is there some sort of conformal dynamics responsible? And there are many scenarios like this that have been proposed. One scenario that I like a lot is the idea of explaining the flavor physics hierarchies using conformal dynamics. You can try to explain the hierarchical structure of quark and lepton masses using this power law renormalization, and it can, the structure that we see in nature can just observe, come out of dynamics. Another nice idea is in supersymmetric scenarios, you can use conformal dynamics to suppress flavor-violating supersymmetry breaking masses that are induced by gravity mediation. This goes under the name of conformal sequestering. You can also try to solve what's called the mu-b-mu problem in gauge mediation using conformal dynamics. Recently, it's also been suggested that you can potentially solve the eta problem in inflation using conformal dynamics, and the list keeps going. So I just want to tell you about one other of these ideas, which is the idea of generating the flavor hierarchies. Well, so if you look up the quark and lepton masses in a table, you'll see that there's, for example, a factor of 10 to the 5 between the top quark mass and the up quark mass. Okay, and more generally, there's a very strange hierarchical structure. These masses come from interactions of the fermions with the Higgs operator and theories with the Higgs particle. This is now just dimension one. And the statement that there are hierarchies is the statement that the coefficients of these interactions, which are 3x3 matrices in flavor space, have a hierarchical structure to their eigenvalues. Well, then the idea is very simple. The idea is that the structure could potentially be explained if different generations have different anomalous dimensions under some conformal dynamics. Okay, it's a very simple idea. If you have some window of energies where, for example, the first generation quarks interact with some CFT operator, the second generation quarks interact with some different CFT operator, these interactions give the generations different large anomalous dimensions, then those anomalous dimensions lead to power law renormalization group running of the Yukawa couplings, and you can dynamically generate a hierarchical structure. Okay, of course, this running has to stop at some scale, and this will stop at for example, if there's some scale where all of the exotic stuff in your CFT sector gets massive and decouples from the theory, just leaving you with a standard model or maybe a supersymmetric extension of the standard model at low energies. So you also want to make sure that you get the CKM matrix right, and that naturally comes out. So in this picture, you can start with basically random order one numbers in the Yukawa couplings, and then this gives you this power law renormalization group running gives you kind of parametric suppressions of different parameters, and then you can write the resulting CKM matrix in terms of those suppressions, and it can fit the observed. So you can write down very explicit models that realize this idea. Most of the explicit models that have been written down in 4D have been supersymmetric realizations of this idea. This was first done by Nelson and Strassler in 2000. More recently, my collaborator and I showed that you could use a technique called amaximization in order to write down very, very concrete models that are simple and calculate the anomalous dimensions. Okay, so you just pick a gauge group and you pick your matter content, and you have some theory which you believe flows to a conformal fixed point, and then you can calculate the anomalous dimensions of all the matter fields in that theory and start to actually quantitatively evaluate how successful various flavor CFTs can be as theories of flavor. One of the reasons why it's possible to calculate the dimensions of the matter fields in these supersymmetric extensions of the standard model are that matter fields in supersymmetric extensions of the standard model are chiral fields, namely they're annihilated by one of the supersymmetry generators. Chiral operators in superconformal theories have dimensions which are related to the U1R symmetry that lives inside the superconformal algebra. And amaximization is a technique to let you determine which U1R symmetry is living inside of the superconformal algebra. In the phases in the Yukawa couplings? Yeah. So those phases you can imagine exist in the theory in the UV, for example. Yeah. Well, if your only operators are the Yukawa couplings at low energies, then you know how to parameterize the phases in those. So if this dynamics generates other operators like four fermion operators and so on, then you might want to worry about other phases that show up. Yeah.
What does this say about low scale supersymmetric partners? The way they
change. Yeah. Very good question.
Just being, you know, now ruled out to 800 GeV. CMS.
Yeah. So in these supersymmetric models, the same dynamics that generates the structure in the Yukawa couplings is going to affect supersymmetry breaking masses, the masses of the supersymmetric particles.
So you expect. And supersymmetric powers below TV.
Well, this structure says nothing about the scale of supersymmetry. Yeah. But what it can do is imprint structure into the spectrum of supersymmetry breaking masses. Okay, and actually one of the reasons that these models are really nice is that they can potentially solve what's called this Susie flavor problem. Which is that if I have, say, Planck-suppressed operators that are giving rise to my supersymmetry breaking masses, so these operators couple the superpartners of the quarks to some field which is responsible for supersymmetry breaking, then in general you might imagine that these are randomly flavor-violating, which can again lead to strong constraints coming from flavor-changing neutral current processes. So it's possible that the same dynamics which generates the structure in the Yukawa couplings can also suppress flavor violation in supersymmetry breaking masses. So that would be a very nice story. On the other hand, the rate at which these kinds of operators flow to zero due to the conformal dynamics is controlled by the dimension of the Q-Bagger Q operators. These are non-chiral operators in supersymmetric theories, and in general, it's very hard to calculate their dimensions. So it's very hard to know the rate at which the supersymmetry breaking masses flow to zero. This is all to bring me to my next point, which is that it's an important problem to better understand the spectrum of operator dimensions in four-dimensional conformally invariant theories. Some concrete questions you'd really like to know in the examples I gave you are the following. Well, in these conformal technicolor models, you'd like to know if it's possible for the dimension of H to be close to 1 and the dimension of H-Decker H to be greater than 4. Not clear if this is possible. In these supersymmetric flavor models, you'd like to know if the same conformal dynamics that generates the Yukawa couplings can also solve the Susie flavor problem. This also depends on relations between dimensions of operators in a slightly more complicated way. And in the last part of this talk, I want to tell you about some recent progress that's been made towards answering questions like these. And that progress is discovering that there are very, very general bounds on operator dimensions in conformal field theories. These bounds, and these are the kinds of bounds that look like they should be constraining scenarios like this. Okay. These bounds are consequences of very basic CFT consistency conditions called crossing symmetry and unitarity, and they've been explored in a series of papers over the last few years. State the constraint that on the spectrum of operator dimensions that we're using in order to derive these bounds. Okay, so this comes from thinking
about four-point functions in conformal field theories. So if I have a four-point function, phi, 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 where all the phis are at different points, here phi is any real scalar operator in the conformal field theory, four-point functions can be expanded in what are called the conformal blocks or conformal partial waves. This expansion comes about by thinking about the operator product expansion, which tells you how to take a product of two operators at a different point and write them as a big sum over operators located at a single point. And by plugging the operator product expansion into four-point functions, you get a representation of the four-point function as a big sum over conformal blocks, G delta L, which are functions of two variables. Each conformal block corresponds to one operator appearing in this operator product expansion. And the conformal block depends on the dimension and the spin of that operator. Now, these conformal blocks are nice functions because they are eigenfunctions of the quadratic Casimir operator of the conformal group. And moreover, they're known explicitly in terms of hypergeometric functions. Okay, I should say these two variables u and v are just the two conformally invariant cross ratios you can build out of formulas. Now this expansion might look a little bit funny because the four-point function phi 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 is symmetric under permutations of all the coordinates. But if you plug in the operator product expansion by choosing two pairs of phis, then this breaks the permutation symmetry. And you actually get a constraint by requiring that the conformal block decomposition is symmetric under, for example, exchanging x1 with x3. Okay? So this constraint is called crossing symmetry. And it's a big sum rule. And it's a sum rule for a continuous range of u's and v's. That is a consistency condition on the spectrum of operator dimensions that can appear in any four-dimensional conformal field theory. Okay? And the bounds that I'm about to show you follow from numerical studies of this constraint. In particular, they follow from, for example, making some assumption about the spectrum of operator dimensions, like all scalar operators appearing in the sum have dimension larger than some delta star. And then under that assumption, you can show via numerical study that this sum rule can never be satisfied under that assumption. Okay, through these kinds of studies, you can rule out various assumptions about the spectrum.
This assumption. I mean, the operator product extension is for nearby points. It's unclear whether you're using this for all distances or.
Right. So
it's some sort of infinite sum. Is that right?
Right. So these conformal. So you can perform the operator product expansion anytime. Your two operators are in a correlation function where all other operators are sufficiently far away.
Right.
Okay, so there's some.
But when you're using this crossing, then it seems like the roles of which ones are close to each other and which ones.
Right. So there's
the car is exchanging.
There is an overlapping region of convergence of the two different kinds of operator product extensions that you can plug into this sum, and so this sum rule. So that overlapping region of convergence corresponds to u and v being between 0 and 1. Okay? So strictly speaking, you expect to be in that region. Okay? So here are some of the current results. This is a bound on the dimension of phi squared as a function of the dimension of phi. Here, phi squared is defined to be the lowest dimension scalar, appearing in the phi cross phi OPE. And you can see that, see here, the x-axis is the dimension of phi, and phi is any real scalar in the four-dimensional conformal field theory. You can see that as the dimension of phi gets close to 1, the bound approaches 2, which is just what you would expect in a free or weakly coupled theory. Okay, and then as the dimension of phi gets further away from 1, there's some curve which tells you that the dimension of phi squared can't get too large. Okay, just to be clear, I should say this gray region is excluded by these bounds. So this very much looks like
what's big N?
N is a parameter. In order to actually study these constraints, this is an infinite number of constraints toward coming from the fact that you have a continuous range of U and V that you can think about. And in order to actually study this in a tractable way, you have to turn it into a finite number of constraints. So this capital N tells you how many constraints you're taking.
How many terms you keep?
Yeah, how many terms you keep. So if you like, what we're doing is Taylor expanding this sum rule around some point in UV space and keeping the finite number of terms in that Taylor expansion. And N tells you how many terms. And so you can see that as N is increasing, it looks like these curves are starting to converge on perhaps some optimal bound. This also looks like it could potentially be very constraining for the ideal sorts of formal technicolor scenarios that I mentioned, where you want the dimension of the Higgs operator to be fairly close to 1, but you want the dimension of the H operator to be greater than 4, ideally. Now there's a loophole in applying this bound to the case of conformal technicolor, which I'll mention in a moment, but this at least looks very promising for constraining these sorts of things. You can also generalize these bounds to n equals 1 superconformal theories. So this is something I did with my collaborator, David Simmons Duffin, last fall. So here is a bound on the dimension of a non-chiral phi number phi operator as a function of the dimension of a chiral operator phi that has dimension b. In order to derive these bounds, required generalizing these constraints of crossing symmetry to n equals 1 superconformal field theories. So something we had to do is derive the explicit form of the n equals 1 superconformal blocks. The things you should notice are that as the dimension of phi gets close to 1, again, the bound approaches 2, as you would expect in a free theory. And this bound is actually much, much weaker than the one on the previous slide, despite the fact that you have supersymmetry helping you. And the reason is that it's somewhat difficult to disentangle the phi dagger phi. So the reason is ultimately that we're talking about a complex scalar, and it can be somewhat difficult to disentangle the phi dagger phi operator from the phi squared operator. Another way to say that is if you want a crossing relation which only involves the operators in the phi dagger cross phi operator product expansion, this involves operators of any integer spin. In particular, it can have both even and odd spin operators. On the other hand, if you have a real scalar, then the operators in the phi cross phi operator product expansion with a real scalar can only contain odd spin, or even spin operators. And that difference is the source of why these bounds are currently weaker.
Am I right? If I have a dimension, say 1.2, is there no bound, or what's that curve doing?
Yeah, that's right. Using our current methods of deriving these bounds, the bound goes away around dimensions of 1.15. So lots of work is in progress in order to improve these bounds and try to push this curve out to larger values in the dimension.
To derive this bound, did you have to truncate the SAMNUR, or you there is just a finite amount of operators?
Sorry, say that again?
To derive the bound in the supersymmetric case,
yes.
Did you have to truncate the SAMNUR or in a finite amount of operators, or you?
So you allow for an infinite number of operators.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you have to turn the constraints of crossing symmetry into a finite number of constraints.
In any case. Okay.
In any case, yeah, that's right.
And is there a physical reason why the bound goes away at 1.2?
No, and I think the reason is that we're not incorporating every constraint that we could possibly incorporate at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So quickly. So the reason is that now we're thinking about 4-point functions like 5-dagger, 5-dagger, 5. And you can perform these operator product expansions, which tells you about the operators in the 5-dagger cross 5 OPE. You get a crossing relation by requiring symmetry under X1 exchanged with X3. There's another way to expand this 4-point function, which is in the 5-5 OBE, okay. Which brings in a new set of operators. And we haven't yet been able to incorporate the constraints that these two expansions are equal to each other. So that's something that's currently in progress. Should also mention that you can bound other interesting quantities in conformal field theories, like the central charge. Here, the central charge is the coefficient appearing in the 2-point function of the stress tensor. This is a bound on the central charge for an arbitrary 4D conformal field theory containing a scalar operator. And this is the lower bound on the central charge. It's a function of the dimension of the lowest dimension scalar of your theory. Okay, so you can see that as the dimension approaches 1, then the bound approaches the contribution to the central charge coming from a free scalar. So this is just what you would expect. Because if the dimension of your scalar is 1, then it's a free field and decoupled from the rest of the theory. And you know that the rest of the theory has to give a positive contribution to the central charge by unitarity. And then these bounds extend that intuition to strongly coupled theories. And you can also get similar bounds in superconformal theories that are stronger. I should also say that these bounds in the central charge kind of have a fascinating interpretation in light of the ADS-CFT correspondence, because the central charge is related to the bulk Planck scale in the ADS-CFT correspondence. And these bounds at least suggest that there should be some sort of fundamental limit to the strength of quantum gravity living in ADS in the presence of light bulk excitations. So I think that this is an intuition that should be explored further in the context of ADS.
Sorry, the general CFT, would that also include the CFT with exactly marginal operator?
Sure.
Or assuming certain about the spectrum, like there are no exactly marginal operators.
Right, this is assuming nothing about the spectrum other than the fact that there is an operator of dimension d, a scalar operator of dimension d in the spectrum, for 4D conformal buildings. So let me just wrap things up. The upshot in the context of the previous part of my talk is that these results are close to, but not quite at the level of placing constraints on the Young-Starr model physics scenarios. In the case of these conformal technicolor ideas. We're still working to disentangle. We're still working to figure out which operator these bounds apply to. In particular, the bounds applied in the case of a real scalar operator. And if you, for example, take a real scalar contained in the Higgs complex doublet and look at it, the OBE of it with itself, in general, that will pick up contributions from both the SU2 singlet H dagger H operator and the SU2 triplet H dagger sigma H operator. And the bound tells you that there must exist one scalar with the mention lower than the bound. So it's not clear if it applies to the operator that we care about or the operator that we don't care about. In these superconformal flavor models, our bounds are still relatively weak on non-chiral operators, but we are now starting to bound the correct thing. And so more work needs to be done in order to strengthen these bounds and start saying interesting things about models. And so work to improve both the numerical algorithms and get a better theoretical understanding of where these bounds come from. I should finish by mentioning that there are a number of complementary approaches to learning about Fourier conformal field theories. One that's seen a lot of amazing progress recently is to study theories with lots of supersymmetry, like n equals 4 sigma Young Mills. And a good question to ask is how many of the very powerful techniques developed in the context of n equals 4 sigma Young Mills can be imported over to theories with less supersymmetry, and that needs to be studied further. Another approach to learning about 4D CFTs is to put theories believed to flow to conformal fixed points on a lattice and study them numerically. There's been some nice recent progress in that direction. Another approach is studying weakly coupled conformally invariant theories and perturbation theory, where you can learn more about structures that maybe will persist to strong coupling. Another very fruitful approach is studying large N theories and the AES CFT correspondence. So something I've been interested in recently is getting a better understanding of effective field theories living in AES that have some cutoff scale, and better understanding the interpretation of that cutoff scale in the dual conformal field theory. So that's been explored recently in some work with these authors. So let me just wrap things up. Let's do some the basic points. One is that approximately scale invariant dynamics could potentially play an extremely important role in the unstable model physics. In these scenarios, it's the spectrum of operator dimensions in the conformal field theory that controls most of the interesting effects. And this needs to be better understood in concrete Fourier conformal field theories without lots of supersymmetry. And a lot of progress is being made on many different fronts, but ultimately there is still plenty of work to be done. And I think there are many avenues where more progress can be made. So thanks a lot.
Regarding these bounds, do you have any ideas on how to separate the effect of the singlet and the triplet?
Yeah, so in principle, it's totally straightforward. So what you're doing is thinking about relation function and Higgs doublet. So there are SU2 indices on these. H dagger H. Then you can think about all of the crossing relations that constrain the various OPEs. Okay? And that's some system of crossing relations, which is larger than just the single sum rule we had in the case of a real scalar. So the straightforward thing to do is to study that system of crossing relations and use all the information that you can and try to extract bounds. The difficult thing at the moment, so that's totally straightforward, and algorithmically it's clear what you would want to do. Currently, the bottleneck is in the numerics, that dealing with systems of crossing relations has turned out to be a numerically difficult problem using the current methods. One thing that's really needed is coming up with either better numerical algorithms for studying these systems of crossing relations, or a better analytical understanding of where these bounds come from. So those are both directions that are important to explore.
Yeah. Suppose that this scenario was right with your composite Higgs and so on, conformal field theory. Would something show up at, say, LHC energies that you could see the difference between that and the fundamental Higgs?
It would certainly look very different than a fundamental.
So what kind of fundamental? What kind of signature would you see?
Right. So it's problem is it's hard to make very robust predictions because we're dealing with strongly coupled theories. You expect that, for example, because of the coupling of this Higgs operator to the top quark, which is fairly large, that you can produce CFT stuff through top loops at a very large rate. This could lead to a whole bunch of resonances appearing in the strong sector that we'll see at the LHC. Another way to produce stuff in the sector is by knowing the fact that it couples strongly to gauge bosons. So, for example, through vector boson fusion, you can produce stuff in the CFT. And the general expectation is that you'll see perhaps a large number of resonances. Perhaps they're very wide. But it's hard to make very robust predictions.
People are searching for the Higgs specifically. Would this influence the way in which they serve? In other words, if they want to find this particular state, will they find it by doing the kind of search that they're doing now, looking for fundamental Higgs, or will they have to look for something different? Would this predict you a negative result looking for a fundamental Higgs?
Right. So they won't see anything that looks like a fundamental Higgs. That's right. I mean, there are also searches for there are searches for Technicolor going on, which look for resonances like Techno Rho and so on. Which are kind of happening alongside searches for a Higgs boson, but it's an orthogonal.
But doesn't this depend on the energy scale in which everything is happening? I mean, if it's happening at a high enough energy scale, how would it look rather like a fundamental Higgs at lower energies, at LHC energies? Do you have some sort of bounds on, you know what I'm saying? I mean, if your whole scenario is a conformal field theory and something is,
yeah,
1,000 TeV.
Yes.
Will you be able to see the difference between this kind of Higgs and the fundamental?
So in Technicolor scenarios, there's no particle which looks like a fundamental Higgs.
Not at all.
Not at all. So you can
get a condensate of some. I don't understand.
Right. So the Higgs particle corresponds to excitations around the expectation value.
Yeah. So why won't that work?
In Technicolor scenarios. You don't expect there to be excitations that look like nice narrow resonances, like you have on the Higgs boson. So you might make very wide resonances, or it might not look like particles at all.
Maybe a related question: what would the unitarity limit that you were looking at, so double double scattering
look
like? How would that be affected?
Yeah, well, so that's something that tells you that you couldn't push this off to an arbitrarily high scale.
If, what would your, what would, what, how would you anticipate this growing in E squared and then turn, presumably turns over? How would it look in contrast to the Higgs scenario?
Right. Right. So in Technicolor scenarios, you have spin one resonances that come in to help you unitarize WW scattering, and these cause the growth of energy to turn over. So typically, you will have a power of spin one resonances that fix this growth.
You can test zero as well.
Yeah.
As well, yeah. Just like the Higgs as well.
Yeah. So it can be some combination of spin zero resonances and spin one resonances that cure the growth. I mean, I think the, you know, generically and strongly coupled theories is hard to say exactly what that turnover will look like.
Seems to me you can make quite definite statements, right? We're saying that the current electron position tests say that the so-called Higgs is, you know, whatever, there's some 120 gel plus or minus 50 gel range. And what you're saying is that in this picture, first of all, there is no narrow resonance. It doesn't have to have the mass of that particular those observers are giving, right? I mean, and even if it exists, if it's like anything like QCD, obviously you're going to get some scalars, and there is a corresponding scalar, and that scalar is very broad, like in 5-5 scattering. So, mm-hmm. Isn't that right? I mean, you're saying that the mass does not have to correspond to the mass. Actually, it's obviously the strongest scalar, but it's not corresponding to what the electroequestrian has to give you for the case.
That's right. If your new strongly coupled sector gives you extra contributions,
right, to then the root will not be narrow,
right.
Even if it exists.
That's right.
So in particular, the Higgs goes to gamma-gamma branching ratio should be much smaller than what's given by the standard model calculations for people who are looking at LHC.
Among the methods that you mentioned for studying conformal field theory,
yeah.
I'd like to suggest one additional new one, which is using a six-dimensional field theory version, which I have constructed for all the conformal field theories. It's a method that I'm calling two-time physics, but there is a six-dimensional theory for every conformal field theory.
Mm-hmm.
And then developing computational tools directly in six dimensions is probably going to be an effective method.
Absolutely. I've looked at these some, and they can be very useful, for example, for figuring out the general forms of correlation functions.
Yes, for example, as well as other things.
And they simplify the derivation of the conformal blocks as well.
Yes.
So I completely agree that that's a useful approach.
Have you compared these bounds that you showed us with some concrete conformal field theory? I mean, is it near to saturating the bound, or are they?
Yeah, good. For example, so one of the nice things about doing these bounds in super conformal field theories is that you can sometimes have a handle on the quantities, and you can potentially bound things that you can calculate. So in super conformal theories, you can calculate the central charge in concrete theories. In most of the examples that I've looked at, the central charge is around 1 or greater. So these bounds aren't coming very close to what occur in actual theories. Now I should say that the situation is a little bit different in two dimensions. So there are also two-dimensional versions of these bounds on operator dimensions, where you also are able to calculate things in many models. There are examples of theories which saturate the bounds that have been calculated. But I think, if you look at these dimension bounds, we don't know of examples of theories that come close to this curve. We do know examples of theories that live along this dotted line, where the dimension of phi squared is 2 times the dimension of phi. This happens in the large n limit of many theories. But it would be very interesting to find examples of theories that come closer to this curve.
Where is QCD in here, if you have to put QCD? Is it possible to put QCD in this graph and say where it will lie?
QCD is not a conformal field theory because the beta function runs.
Oh, I see.
So the gauge coupling runs.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you need an exact conformal field theory.
So these bounds are true in an exact conformal field theory. The hope is that in scenarios where you might have an approximate conformal invariance, that they will still kind of morally give you.
So have you studied what happens if you put some perturbations that?
Yeah, that's a good. Well, so this power law running that I was talking about is an example of that.
So you cannot do logarithmic running with power law running. When QCD is logarithmic running, right?
If this is e to the gamma log mu, right? So if gamma is small, then you get what looks like logarithmic running. But if it's a large normal dimension, then it's power law running. So here, if I have an exact CFT and I perturb it by some operator, then we know what happens to that perturbation at leading order. Understanding the back reaction of that on the CFT sector is a harder problem, where I think more work needs to be done to better understand it.
Very good. So I'm happy with so many questions. Let's thank David.